starting afresh in a completely new situation that was unfamiliar to all of us, and it was unfamiliar to her. And therefore, it was a thing one had to work out ad hoc as one went on.
And she was rather good at handling ad hoc situations, I suppose, wouldn't she?
Very, I should say.
her fitness and her sort of initiative and all that sort of thing would all be useful, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Situation.
And she could do almost anything. Do you remember her back just chuck her out after that dance performance?
Yes.
Most efficiently. I came into the quad, and there was Lady Stocks, wasn't Lady Stocks then, and the chief scout, between them, propelling out a very, very drunk undergraduate, saying, I'll write you a letter of apology on notepaper from the British Academy.
Did she believe very much in delegating, that is, leaving people to get on with their own job as much as possible, or was she a more active, inquiring sort of principle?
I don't think she left them to get on with their own job.
I don't think so.
She was interested, extremely interested in what she was doing, but she assumed you'd do it and get on with it.
So she really sort of mobilises other people to work under their own steam, in a sense, rather than driving them directly herself.
Yes, I would have said so, but of course good principle wouldn't drive.
Yes, would college principle.
It's, that seems to be a college principle's thing, really.
Yes, I quite agree, yes.
One of the things we realised afterwards, how much she knew about the students, wasn't it?
Yes.
And how she found it all out, I don't know. But after she returned, she kept up relations with many of them for years, didn't she? And followed, did she know? It's a surprising amount.
She got to know them.
She got to know them individually, yes, rather.
Did she?
And helped them. She was really good in helping lame ducks, wasn't she?
But you never knew about it.
We didn't know about it. It turned up after she ceased to be principal.
Yes.
And she started talking about them.
How did she do that? Did she see them all individually?
Well, I suppose she must have.
It was our principal in Westfield Works, you know. What the job's like. Is it like being here?
Of course, it was relatively small then, wasn't it? The principal had more time to see people. She had them quite often up to coffee in small groups.
Did she?
They'd all been entertained once or twice, and probably more.
But she would tell you afterwards things that she remembered about them, which you wouldn't have thought she could possibly have known. And at the time, you had no impression that she was fussing after them or worrying with them. She simply did know and remember these things. And the number of people she'd got through difficult situations, we never knew about it. But she could do that.
She was good with young people then, would you say?
Very.
She's got some element of youthfulness about herself, hasn't she? That's partly what helped, I suppose, including this health.
Yes.
But what else is in then, do you think, that enables her to get on with them? A good listener, perhaps?
Lack of pretension. Wouldn't you think?
Yes, I think so. She's utterly without pretension.
So they felt they could say anything to her and there wasn't any stiffness or formality about her.
We really don't know, I think, how she found out so much about them. Do you?
That really is and she kept in touch with them afterwards.
Many of them, she kept in touch, I suppose, until she died.
Yes.
We used to meet them at those Christmas parties, the New Year's Eve parties she always gave.
Yes.
What were those then? The principals at Westfield always give?
Just her own. They were at Christmas, really, because
Christmas Eve, wasn't it?
Camden Hill Square, they light candles in the windows, and it's rather an exciting thing to see. So she always had a running party on Christmas Eve, and everybody went.
Just
to
Westfield people?
Oh, no, 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 no,
all sorts of people there.
Very exciting,
tremendous range of friends, interesting and distinguished people, many of them. And then all of us mixed up.
Yes, yes, they were fascinating parties.
Was she good at social functions then, organising a party?
In one way, and in one way not.
Now you're better with this.
No, I was only thinking that she was so much interested herself that she was very apt to sort of crash in and take over a conversation, that sort of thing.
Yes, her predecessor was an absolutely marvellous hostess, quite wonderful at organising part and doing everything at the right moment. And Lady Stocks imparted a tremendous vitality to it. Whereas Christina says she very often crashed in at entirely the wrong moment.
She'd be very interested in the intellectual side of the thing, I suppose. Too concerned with that, to be concerned with the social proprieties, particularly.
I suppose so, but these things never mattered, did they, really?
But anyway, she gave parties of that sort, so that's another occasion when she could meet the staff and that sort of associate. What about governing body meeting? You presumably have a single governing body, do you, at Westfield?
We have a council.
Council, and she chairs that?
No, she doesn't chair it. The chairman of council is an external person.
Oh, I see.
And there was about an equal number of external people and internal people.
So she's just one of the committee?
She would simply be one of the committee.
Yes.
Well, she said at the beginning when she came to it, I think after her experience in Oxford, that she felt very much as if it was an external council. She was the head of a the strange Victorian school being called up before it. But I don't think that lasted very long. To begin with, I think she probably found that difficult.
Because we have no direct experience of that during the war, have we? Because
no.
The meetings held in London.
Well, I was on it.
Well, you were on during the war.
Yes. But by the time I was on it, she'd obviously got it eating out of her hand.
Had she really? How did she handle that rather odd assembly? It sounds rather a strange assembly in a way for someone, not an easy one.
No, I don't think it was an easy one to handle.
What was the secret of her success?
Doing her homework very thoroughly.
And knowing she has a quick mind, it's now part of expression.
Yes.
It's the past that I think of any other member around there.
A quick... Quite a frame motion, things like that.
And to
see the point.
See the point.
Yes.
But she did know her stuff extremely well, and that is part of the secret of it.
Yes. That's very interesting. So, on the business side of the college, which presumably she runs in collaboration with some sort of bursar, does she, or what? Quite how you run things.
Well, she had then a secretary to council. Who did a lot of the administrative side, and a registrar and a bursar, and then she'd have had the senior members of the academic board on it with her, and one or two junior representatives like me at that stage, and then all these outside people.
Did she have a sort of policy for Westfield, in a sense? I mean, did she see it as going in any particular direction? Did she have a view of Westfield, really?
Well, I think she had a view of it as part of her view of women's education. And she thought very strongly that they ought to take a completely equal place with men in public affairs, and she thought they ought to be very well trained for it. And she'd have seen Westfield, as any other college, if it happened to be dealing with women, dealing with them in that kind of way, I'd say.
I mean, she didn't have any sort of particular policy of it, vis-à-vis London University as a whole, or, I mean, the relationship between Westfield and London University, or with other colleges.
strikes me there is that after the war, when, do you remember this, we'd been slightly blitzed, not very badly blitzed. She thought we should stand down absolutely, yes, because Bedford had been badly hit, and that the decent thing was to take a rather second place in the physical building up and the financial building up of West Coast, because Bedford needed it so much more.
Yes, yes, yes.
I don't think she was a person who was ambitious for her college, Quay College. I think she was ambitious for the education of women, but if somebody else had had a hard time, then she would have stood back for them.
Mm. Did she actually bring outsiders into the college at all? I mean, you remember,
oh, very much.
Yes. Did she?
Yes.
I mean, these, you mentioned this distinguished range of people that you met at her parties. Did she utilise that for the benefit of the college at all, that range of connections?
Remember Golden Mary at the war, yes, cutting out Regius, his translations of Greek plays before they were published, before they were actually finished sometime.
Yes. And Eileen Pye, you remember Eileen Pye, she was much more of a historian.
Yes, I remember her coming.
Yes, she did, and Temple. Yes, she brought, and the girl who looked purr like a cat, not I mean Ishara, one who gave the concerts
at Barra. Yes.
No, but she was a musician.
She was a musician. She gave Harriet Cohen.
Yes.
Yes, she did bring out distinguished outsiders into the lot. And she got people to meet them, and she got the students to meet them. It was one of the big things she did.
Would that wouldn't be done in the chapel, though, particularly, would it? I mean, it would be down on some sort of social
function. Oh, much more social.
Yes. Yes.
You see, Gilbert Murray came in to lunch, and then he spent the afternoon reading his plays.
Yes. That's really quite
that
a
sort
fine,
of thing. My goodness, it was.
We were discussing Gilbert Murray earlier, weren't we, in some context?
Eliezer would talk.
Oh, yes.
Well, she thought Eliezer was just like him. Eliezer would talk. Well, she had a tremendous regard for a man who wouldn't compromise on principles. And in chapel, I remember her several times reading the lesson, which I think comes from one of the books of the Maccabees, about Eliezer, who was an old man, very much loved by the young. And she said once to me, she thought he must be exactly like Gilbert Murray. And in a time of persecution, when the Jews were being forced to eat pork as a sign of conformity with the Gentile world, the young men who admired him brought him some innocuous meat and said, eat this, which is entirely in accordance with your religion, and just pretend you're eating pork. And Eliezer absolutely refused and said no, he'd served the Lord for 8 to 5 years and he wasn't going to rat on him at this point. And therefore, he was put to death with more spite and more horror because he'd stood out at the last moment. And she had a tremendous admiration for him. And I think she saw Gilbert Murray as the same kind of person, which he was, of course.
Yes. How does one reconcile that side of her concern for principle with her capacity for running things? I mean, there is superficially, anyway, a contradiction between those two qualities, isn't there?
Yeah. Why should there
be? I mean, principle implies prickliness, doesn't it? Resignings, resignations,
yes,
that sort of mentality, doesn't it?
Oh, no. No. After all, your principles are fairly few, and you can make them perfectly clear, and you can stick to them. In anything that isn't a strict matter of principle, she'd be perfectly willing to compromise and adapt and be tactful. And if you know where your principles lie, and everybody else knows where they lie, that's simple enough, I think.
What were her principles then?
Your turn, Mr.
Academic integrity.
Oh yes.
Academic integrity, fidelity. never pushing for herself.
Or for the college when it would conflict.
Or for the college when it would conflict with charity. Being prepared to do anything, however menial, if she thought it should be done. Keeping your sense of humour. Welcome, God bless.
Did you actually see a lot of her sense of humour?
Oh, yes.
It was always coming out.
Oh, yes.
Like to live with.
Not in the sense of telling jokes in a formal way, presumably.
She was telling very funny stories.
Was she?
Yes. She told them very well. She did tell them rather repeatedly, but they were jolly good stories. I mean, my story about her telling a committee not to behave like a volcanic molehill was absolutely true.
It's very typical.
Very typical.
Also, presumably, preparedness to take infinite trouble with young people when they were in difficulties.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Do you remember Tilda Rena?
Yes.
Tilda Rena, whose real name I won't give you, was an unfortunate student who was slightly off her head. And at one point, in the middle of the war, ran away and disappeared. And Lettice was seen running down a street in some extraordinary place.
Burford or
King Norton or some place. And Lettice talked, so I had to go and run her to Earth and feel her and get her bag. And she was absolutely marvellous, Tilda Rena, who was, I must say, as difficult as they make them. And Tilda Rena, you know, it comes out of the name of, whose play?
I'm not over there at all.
Well, yes. Anyhow, it's an 18th century play.
Yes.
Play. She's the comic daughter of the keeper of Tilbury Castle, the Mad Hatter. Yes. And that's why she got that name. But
Baptized her,
yes. Yes, we always knew her as Tilda Rena. But she, with that sort of case, she'd be absolutely marvellous.
Yes, she went off in the middle of the night, along with you.
Yes, rather, and flashed out of a cellar in this extraordinary place. But it was typical. She'd just take that in her stride.
And with a sort of tact in dealing with personal relationships.
Yes, marvellous.
Yes, yes. But these principles of hers, then, they wouldn't be advertised particularly, then, would they? You'd just know from observing her conduct that they were there. Is that right?
I should think so, yes.
Yes.
She certainly wouldn't have talked about them very much.
That's very interesting. I don't quite understand why the Apocrypha is so important. So, I mean, is it just that nobody else knows the Apocrypha, that it was rather striking to you that she did? Or was it
no, because it is... it's a collection of books, in some of which there is absolutely magnificent literature and extremely impressive religious teaching, and she spotted it, and most other people haven't. It's only because she really knew her sources very much better than most of us.
You say rather interestingly that in fact, you weren't surprised that her religion wasn't a great consolation to her at the end of her life, because her religion wasn't of that type. Can you explain what you meant when you said that? Her religion was a sort of framework, really, was it? Not a personal consolation.
I think it was extremely deeply held. Extremely living to her, but she wasn't the kind of person to seek for consolation. Or I imagine to have the slightly sentimental qualities makes it easy to seek for consolation. But I'm putting that very badly.
I see.
Can you get it?
No, I can't. I don't know.
You see, Dr. Harrison said that, as Helen said, in the last years of her life, she didn't feel tremendous religious consolation in the fact of being near death and that kind of thing. She didn't feel the immediate presence of Christ or anything like that. But I don't think she would. I think it was too, in a way, too intellectual, too historical. It's awfully difficult because I think I'm maybe thinking of mine rather than hers in a way. But I do see the quality in her mind that would have said, a great deal of what has been said about religious consolation is to me quite bogus. She often talked to me about prayers and hymns and things, and I remember her saying that the hymn about what rapture it be, prostrate before thy throne, to lie and gaze on thee, meant absolutely nothing to her. She could have no feeling about the rapture of worship in that sense. And that's, I think, when she said, I don't want to spend eternity in rapture, I want to spend it in being John Stocks' wife. In the same way, the hymn, New Blessings Each Returning Day, hover about us while we pray, she said, worried her, she hated to think of things hovering about her, it made her think of gnats. you see, she was an enormously religious person. She had a tremendous strength of the feeling of the existence of God and the intervention of God in human affairs and the redemption of mankind through Christ. But I don't think she would ever have expected to think of God so to speak holding her hand when she was in a tight place.
It rather fits, in a way, with the personal austerity of her life, doesn't it? I mean, she doesn't look for comfort anywhere, really, does she? I mean, life is really rather hard, isn't it?
I think life was hard for her.
I think you also said something about John Stocks and her great fondness for John Stocks being a major stabilising
factor. Oh, I'm sure, yes.
Yes.
She was enormously in love with him and had an enormous respect for him, and that's what stabilized her in her idea of women's movements. She never thought women's movements as being opposed to men or being the result of oppression by men. She thought of men and women in the best sense working together, and she'd always have thought that he had a better brain than hers and looked up to him in that sort of way. And I think that stabilized her whole feeling about the emancipation of women, which she believed very strongly, but she saw it as part of a civilized approach together with men, not an antagonism. A joint approach. And I'm sure that was the result of that extremely happy marriage.
How do you know that John Stocks was so important? Was she always talking about him or mentioning him in conversation or what he'd said, or was it just your deduction?
No, she wasn't always doing it. It was very... Do you remember the Giorgione picture of the young man that she had, because he was like John Stocks? That was all the...
I think she had at her desk, yes. And when she did talk about him, it was with a great sense of living love.
Yes.
She didn't talk about him much, but you could feel that all through.
That's interesting. There's one thing which I'd like to ask you, which I am puzzled about. Mary Stocks wrote a rather perceptive article on Mary Stocks in The Guardian about 10 years ago, where she said,
Mary Stocks,
and she said something like, I'm paraphrasing here, that Lady Stocks relished her fame on the BBC and her opportunity on the BBC, particularly because she found she was communicating with a large number of people thereby, as a person who found it rather difficult to communicate with people on an individual basis. I was rather surprised by that, because I met her, and I didn't feel that she was found difficulty in communicating with people, but I don't know whether you
that's
feel
not
that.
My impression, is it?
No, I wouldn't know that.
No.
I didn't find that. I didn't feel
I think she communicated well. She just liked the BBC because it gave her more chance of doing what she liked.
Yes.
And she obviously liked people.
Liked people, yes.
When you heard her on the BBC, did you think, oh yes, that's Mary?
Yes.
Oh yes.
I mean, she just wasn't any different.
No,
not at all.
She
was in Westfield, I mean, just herself.
And you could have heard two words on the BBC and known it was Mary Stocks and nobody else. It was a very typical approach.
And you didn't entirely agree with me when I said that she her strength on the BBC was that she could formulate clearly what everybody else was thinking. You disagreed with that somewhat, didn't you? You thought that she had considerable originality as well.
I thought she had a very original mind.
Yes.
And I thought it came out in some of her morning broadcasts. And she was an awfully original and interesting person. I was for a bit on a committee dealing with the Minister of Women in the Church, and it had on it, you know, a lot of rather pompous and rather solemn and serious-minded people, both men and women, and she was incredibly refreshing in that, because she'd always come out with some rather bubbling kind of remark that took the pomposity out of it.
She was sort of spontaneous and unaffected always.
Yes.
Yes. Well, that, I mean, young people would like that very much, wouldn't they?
Oh, I think
one
so.
One of the roots, as you say, of her popularity, her success. They really are bringing her to light. Well, what else would you draw attention to that we haven't talked about to bring out her personality and her way of doing things? She has a tremendous sort of down-to-earthness about her, sort of common sense about her, doesn't she? Which
yes,
is
yes.
Refreshing, combined with humour.
Yes.
Pleasure in simple things.
Do you remember the cat party?
Yes.
When her cat, Canada, had its 100th kitten, we had a party to which a very select cross-section of the college was invited. And the people who weren't invited couldn't make out why the people who had been invited went to it. And actually, it was because they were fond of cats. And it went right down, you know, from the senior common room to the junior domestic staff. And they all turned up. We all had sherry, and Canada had fish. And that was rather typical of her, I think. And the way one of her kittens fell, wasn't hurt, from the gallery in the old house at college, a little white one, and she had to have a safety net put in. And she said it came down and reminded her so much of "Lo, he comes like clouds descending." that was rather typical of Stockton.
I was rather surprised when I met her how small she was, actually. I was measured with her voice and rather forthright views on that she'd be quite a big woman. She was quite small, really, wasn't she?
She was tall.
Reasonably tall, very slight, isn't she?
Yes.
And very gaunt looking, in a way, wasn't she? Rather gaunt face.
Well, I should have said gaunt.
Well, in the extreme old age.
Yes, I suppose old age.
You were
old
age.
Yes.
When a drawing was made of her in college, we've got two portraits of her, both extremely bad, but the drawing is rather better than the painting. And it's rather better than the painting because she secretly, and without having telling anybody except us, took it out of its frame and improved it. frightful. She ought to have been done by Epstein. We couldn't afford it. The man who did draw her, paint her looking extremely limp and static, which he certainly wasn't. And it was presented by Gilbert Murray, who presented it to her, and she presented it to the college. And both of their speeches are absolute models of tact, showing extreme gratitude and being incredibly polite, and yet at the end of it you knew just what each of them thought of the thing.
How did she combine being a mother with being principal? I mean, where were her children at that time?
They were grown up.
Yes,
she was very fond of them. She was a very devoted mother. But you see, Anne was in the civil service and just about to get married when she came to us.
John was in the Navy.
John was in the Navy, and Helen was 16, just about leaving school. Mm. So they were really launched. They used to come and stay in college quite a lot. We saw quite a lot of them. But I doubt if she'd have taken the job if they'd been very little and she'd had to cope with them. Mm. Do you remember her story about the fried fish shop?
No.
Well, this is one of her reminiscences. She'd worked an awful lot in Liverpool, you know, doing things. She'd been a magistrate, and she'd been very much in on the founding of birth control clinics in the slum end of Liverpool, which I knew a good bit, and my goodness, it was slummy, and had an awful time, I think, because there was a large Irish Roman Catholic population which didn't mince its words, and she would stand up to that magnificently. I remember her telling us one story about a case that came up for her as a magistrate in Scotland Road. Do you know Scotland Road?
No, I don't know.
Well, Scotland Road is Bethnal Green, roughly, before Bethnal Green was cleaned out, where a terrific riot had broken out in a fried fish shop, because two other clients had come in, two female clients, and one had called the other one a dirty madam, to which the other one had replied, "But you are the mother of a tuppenny cow." Whereupon, the fried fish shop took sides, and they all seized fried fish and threw it at the other side. And the whole case was brought up for Lady Stocks on the bench. And what the outcome of it was, I don't know, but I remember her telling that story with enormous relish.
She didn't have any sort of class prejudice. She'd get on with anybody.
Yes.
I mean, she got on very well, for instance, with Nick Fowler, didn't she?
Oh, yes. City. Yes. She had no, I should say, no class prejudice or feeling in that way at all.
Except anti snobbery, presumably. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Her politics, she was really sort of centre left, really, wasn't she, politically?
She was a strong Labour. She was Fabian, I should think.
Yeah.
Yes.
She told me once that she thought she really was, in her later years, a liberal rather than a socialist.
Yes.
But I think she'd got that Gladstonian liberal to Fabian approach.
Mm.
She could certainly never have been a conservative, but she would also never have been a communist.
No, and she came out, didn't she, in 1973 or so, with an attack on Wedgwood Bend, didn't she? Just before she died, I think, how she... He frightened her, she said.
Yes.
Something like that.
Do you remember her remark, it must have been fairly short before she died, and they asked her what she thought of Lady Faulkner in the House of Lords. Did you know the answer to that part?
No, I didn't.
All sorts of why should I mind? All sorts of extraordinary people get into the House of Lords. I mean it myself.
Oh, yes.
Did she do any teaching in Westfield?
A little in the history department. She was a columnist, you see, so she did some economic history for us, but not very much. She perhaps did a couple of hours a week, that kind of thing.
Mm.
She wouldn't really have time for more.
Why did she enter it? Just because she wanted to keep her hand in?
Oh, she enjoyed it.
It was rather a tradition of the college, wasn't it? The principals usually did a little bit.
I see, yes. Yes. I imagine she'd be very clear as a tutor, actually, in explaining things.
Yes, I think she probably would.
But she brought Eileen Power to the college, what, to sort of give lectures, did she?
No, just as a friend.
Did she?
But rather typically, you see, when she brought a personal friend who was also a very interesting person in, she'd give the students a chance of meeting them.
Eileen Power was a major influence on her, wasn't she?
Oh, I think so, yes. And I think R.H. Torley was.
Yes, yes. Yes, she really does fit in very much, doesn't she, to that sort of Christian socialist tradition that
yes.
was really rather dying as influence of the Labour Party now, but was so very important. But what about amateur dramatics? I mean, she was very keen on the theatre, wasn't she?
Yes. She wrote two or three plays. And I don't remember seeing her act, do you? I remember seeing the students take her off frequently,
yes.
But I don't remember seeing her act. She was very interested in the theatre.
Did she?
Yes.
Did she encourage it in the college? I mean, or was she particularly sort of noted for?
She was interested in it. Would always turn up their plays and things. But I can't remember more about it than that.
In her Manchester days, she was certainly very active on that front.
Yes. Well, that was when she wrote things like Hail Nero, wasn't it? And
yes, and a thing about the Chartists as well.
Yes.
Incidentally, she had a Chartist hymn was sung, I think, when at her husband's funeral service. And I think her children chose a Chartist hymn her
memorial
service as well, or her funeral service.
When
will
Thou Save the People?
That's right. Yes.
Yes. Well, the two hymns she wanted, and told us that she wanted, were For Mercy, Pity, Peace and Love, and the All Day hymn, you know, Lord of All Hopefulness. And those are the two that she's particularly fond of. More so, I think, than the Chartist one. Because those are the two for which she asked.
Mm. Yes, that's obviously the Bible is just terribly important, isn't it, in her whole upbringing. I suppose it was in the middle class upbringing of so many of her generation, wasn't it, whereas it's not now.
She wouldn't have thought of that in the middle class.
No.
Well, what was her upbringing, or whether she discovered it?
I think she discovered it. I rather thought that her upbringing was more like mine than like yours, you know, that she'd more of the sort of late Victorian worthy agnostic tradition
yes.
than the traditional Christian tradition.
You're right, I can't quite remember what she said about that.
I'm not sure about that, but I'd rather have guessed that there yes. was a good stand of that somewhere.
What sort of accommodation did she have when you moved back into Westfield after coming back from Oxford?
Well, she had the traditional principal's accommodation, which was a sort of flat on the first floor of the thing that's called the old house. It's the Desmos Burton bit of the college, which is very lovely. And I think she enjoyed that enormously because she did very much like things to be beautiful.
But not a sort of self-contained flat, was it?
Not really, no. It was just
a fine sitting room and a bedroom. But no sort of special precautions for principal, or no separation from the rest of the people living there.
No.
So did you get the same feeling of austerity in personal comforts there as you got in Oxford?
Well, it was more comfortable, we were all a bit more comfortable, but after the first year or two, when, you know, our windows were bombed out and were replaced by bits of brown paper and that kind of thing. Yes, I think she was always an austere person, but she was then living in a very beautiful room, and I think she liked that very much.
Yes. And she had some beautiful things herself, didn't she? But she was very generous. She left them after college.
Yes.
Did she? Because I think Helen said to me that they always worried at the end of her life, because she had those nice things, that people would visit her, and then
That would be quite difficult.
And they found that she just gave it away and didn't replace it. Mm. You know.
Yes, she was a most unpossessive person.
Yes, that's I can't quite remember when she retired from Westfield.
51, wasn't it?
Yes, so it was really before her BBC career.
Yes, her BBC career took on at that point.
Yes.
She'd been interested in BBC, but I think had hardly done anything except when she might have been called in, you know, as a distinguished woman to give her the honor.
She was on some commission, wasn't she, about
the BBC? I believe she was.
Well, wasn't she on the commission about the commercial television?
That's it,
And she was terribly worried, you remember, she foresaw this business about the exploitation of the young by advertisement, and was awfully worried about it at that stage. I think that was the thing that always haunted her a good deal. But she built up her BBC career after she'd left ours.
Mm-hmm.
She retired fairly young at 16, see, and stopped at
the She has three lives, really. Well, more than three lives, but I mean, she has, in a sense, you give her a new lease of life, don't you? Well, she ceased to be a mother.
Yes.
And has become a person academically in her own right. And then she leaves you, and she has a BBC career, which is really quite
different. Well, it's quite different.
It's an interesting life she had, really.
Well, she had this tremendous vitality. She could start a new thing.
And then, of course, she immensely enjoyed the Lords, didn't she?
Yes, you're quite right.
And she immensely enjoyed being down at West Bay and sailing a boat, which she did very well.
Did she really? Mm. You mentioned it then that Eleanor Rathbone was a very important influence on her.
Yes.
How did you notice that, really?
Oh, I think the moment she talked about her. Mm-hmm. I imagine Eleanor Rathbone had been one of the early balanced feminists, you see, and had managed to do an enormous amount of work. And in fact, she went on doing an enormous amount of work right up to her death. But she wasn't always throwing her weight about. And I think Lady Stocks appreciated that. And also she thought it was a rap that was a great humanitarian, which she was.
Yes. She actually was interesting. She lent me a volume of Eleanor Rathbone's addresses to the National Union of Societies for Equal Citizenship called Landmarks.
Oh, did she? Yes.
About a year before she died. She said, if you want to see something really good, read this.
Yes.
And I borrowed it from her. But you see her then, in a sense, as a feminist. Did you feel that she was always championing women in a sensible way? I mean, you see her as a feminist, really, do you?
Difficult answer that. I think she thought that women were people and men were people, and that was the most important thing about them. I don't think she would ever have been very shrill or excitable about them, but she certainly thought that they should have a fair look in and that they weren't getting it.
And that was, in a way, one of her principles, if you like, guiding her.
Yes.
But not manifesting itself in any aggressive or unconstructive way.
I think it was, really. I think, you see, on this business of the Equal Ministry of Women, when I sat with her on that committee, that she wasn't aggressive or forceful about pushing women to the ministry, because it was absolutely impossible for her to see any reason why they shouldn't be ministers. You see, that she thought a woman equal to a man might receive a vocational call, and if she did, that was that. And that the fact of her sex in that work was totally irrelevant.
Mm. You only really insist when you've got nagging doubts in your own mind, perhaps. Or
yes. And I don't think she had any doubts.
Yes. Why did she actually retire so early then? I would have thought she'd have gone on to 65 at least.
Well, she got to retiring age, and at that stage you could retire at 60, you could retire at 65. I think probably she felt she'd done her work in Westfield, and I dare say she wanted to get on to the other career while she'd still got the spring in her to do it.
She'd done what she thought she had it in her to do at Westfield and wanted to move on to make a contribution somewhere else, you think?
I think she had. I think she possibly disagreed with some of the council policy about sounds. What would you say, Christine?
Well, as a matter of fact, I don't know how far this is indiscreet. She retired because she wasn't asked to stay on. At that stage, she was had so much on her platter that I think the people who had to make this decision thought that she was going hardly to have time to college with hers. I think it was a mistake, but I think it was the college's choice rather than hers. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you should spread that all around.
No,
I understand. It's no discredit to her, but just that she had so very many things on.
So really you think that her new life...
I think she would have gone on quite likely and have overlapped the two things to you.
I think she would have.
And I think she was sitting in the Parliament, and she was one stage, she was very anxious indeed to get into Parliament.
Yes.
She wanted it very much.
As a university member.
And I think the feeling was that this really couldn't be combined with a principalship.
Mm. On the other hand, of course, looking at it in a more distant way, it brings credit to the college if they've got a
very much so,
yes.
Yes.
It's difficult to get that balance right, too, isn't it?
Yes, I think it was a mistaken decision, but I think that was it, really, was it?
So it's not really that she acquired a new career when the old ones ended, it's that the new career was already growing.
It was already growing.
It was already growing and rather threatening to engulf the old one.
Yes. Well, that was when we had university members, you see, in Parliament, and she was a very obvious choice to run for one.
But of course, they were abolished in 1948, weren't they? That is before she retired from Westfield. But I mean, she would have conflicted earlier on.
Yes.
Because she stood, didn't she stand against Simon?
Yes. I've forgotten who the other man was, but there was a three-cornered one.
Yes, I can't remember off.
And she and Simon were much too much on the same line, really.
Mm. Well, Simon, she admired Simon.
Oh, yes. Yes, I think they were great friends.
Because another thing she said to me was, I said, in a sense, indiscreet way, I suppose, I said, I thought your biography on Rathbone was extremely good. She said, oh, well, you ought to read my letter, Simon, that's my best book.
Yes, well, she did know him awfully well.
I've read that, have you?
No, I haven't.
I read it actually just the other week. It's a very good, sensitive biography.
Yeah.
So if, in a sense, you didn't ask to carry on, I suppose, there weren't any sort of emotional farewells or anything for her. She just left.
We had lots of parties and then.
Did you?
Yes,
good. And there wasn't any benefit.
Oh, heavens, no, we had a lot of set off. Mm. And the students did masks and things. And
did they really?
Not that.
Do you think, what did she really do for Westfield, if you had to sum it up? What was her contribution to Westfield's life? Its history, really. Keeping it alive during the war, I suppose, is a major achievement in itself, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, I think she shook it out of being old-fashioned, wouldn't you?
Yes.
When I came to it, you see, not fresh from Oxford, but fresh from a provincial university after Oxford, I loved it, but I thought this is a little bit lavender and old lace. Mm. But it wasn't after she'd got at it.
And she did that partly by this sort of ballet dancer act, that sort of thing, breaking the atmosphere. Is that it, do you think, partly? Is that how she does it?
Partly that, partly by an enormously vivid and well-informed knowledge of an attitude to what was going on outside.
Yes.
She was very good, very up-to-date with current affairs.
Yes.
And of course, all these outside connections, which I think were actually a very great value for the college.
Yes. She did, I think somebody said of her, I don't know who it was, that she really was rather fascinated by power. That is not that she wanted power herself, but that she was interested in the business of exercise of power, and that was one of the great attractions of the House of Lords for her. She could see these people who were pulling the strings and talk to them and so on. Does that at all ring a bell with you?
It does for me, doesn't it?
Well, I think she might have been awfully interested in seeing how it worked. I don't think she particularly wanted to work it herself.
No, I think that's right. I mean, it's a sort of sociological interest in a way, isn't it? I mean, an interest in the way society operates.
Yes.
More than anything else. But she also, another of her loves was London.
Very much.
Did you notice that at all?
Oh, yes. She gave us a marvellous lecture on London once.
Yes, she knew it as well as she knew the Bible.
Thank goodness she did, yes. Do you remember how at the ending about how you went down away from it, down the Thames, and saw the little boats going out?
I heard that lecture.
You didn't hear it?
I did.
Oh, yeah. It was fascinating. Yes, she knew it extraordinarily. And she knew an extraordinary number of walks in London, around bits that nobody ever does know. And I think she was really happier in London than anywhere else.
Yes, I think her children thought that too. She'd always walk everywhere too. She couldn't take a taxi.
Yes.
In fact, taxis were rather out.
She'd either walk or drive in her little car.
She drove.
She had a rather horrid accident in it when she was thrown out of it. It was a small, rather ancient car, very characteristic. It was red, wasn't it?
Yes.
And it looked a bit antiquated. It went very well, very fast.
She was a safe driver, was she?
Oh, yes.
Well, not erratic.
Yes, very safe. Oh, when the thing ran into her, it was entirely the fault of the other thing. No, I think she's a very safe driver.
Yes.
But she obviously enjoyed it.
On clothing, you say that anything she wore looked quite good.
Yes.
But she didn't make a fuss about it. She was positively against makeup, wasn't she?
Yes, I think she was.
I never saw her wear it.
No. I don't think she minded it a little. She couldn't be bothered, you know. She didn't want to spend the time on that sort of thing.
Yes. And likewise food.
Again, she really wouldn't very much have noticed.
Yes. Because she didn't need to bother personally, did she, in the college? Because it's all done.
No, it was done.
Yeah.
But so you see, I think Helen or maybe Nan told me that the end of her life, it was as much as they could do to make sure she ate, because she just lived out of tins and she couldn't be bothered.
Yes,
that would have been very difficult.
Yes.
If you'd been going to lunch with her, she would have made an effort, and she'd have made an extremely nice dish, and it would have been one of the two. But if she'd been having her own lunch, it would probably have been bread and cheese.
Mm. Well, that's right, I think.
And you remember the butter.
Which is the great butterer.
Not the great butterer, no. Well, when we were in Oxford, instead of chapel, we had the Church of St. Peter the Veil in the middle of the quad, where we always had our morning service. And we always used to take on butter, because you took your butter ration in the hall in those days. So it was put in the porch outside, and at the end of morning prayers, we went out, picked up your butter, and went into breakfast, you see. Well, on one occasion, her cab counter got in and licked the butter. We came out to the sky. Gambler sampling the little bowl of butter which we put all round the porch, you see. And Lady Stocks was being, hers was being well and truly licked, but she picked it up and just sort of brushed it and took it into the room with him. So we all did.
That's okay. You said, I think, earlier that she was really very patriotic. How did you notice that, really?
Again, her rather magnificent readings in chapel, I think. She was a bit bloodthirsty, wasn't she? Do you remember the Song of Deborah?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, but the more ferocious bits of the Song of Deborah came out. Oh, yes. All her readings, Time of Dunkirk, Time of Arnhem. She'd always got one of these absolutely magnificent Old Testament things for it. And yes, I think you would just see the patriotism running through that. The time of the parachute attack in France, you know, it came on Whit Sunday. Mm. Well, 2 days after, she said to me, I'll never be able to sing hymns about the parachute descending again as long as I live.
Did she drink at all, or was she a teetotaler?
She wasn't a teetotaler. She didn't drink much. I mean, but she'd...
She'd drink socially.
Yeah. You know, the old sherry party and that kind of thing.
Yes, yes. Well, you've given me a very, very nice, sort of nicely rounded picture. You see, I in a way, she's not only casual, she's quintessentially English, I always feel. I always felt at the time that she could only be an English woman. I don't feel that she had anything, although she liked travelling, there was nothing un-English about her. I don't know whether you feel that.
She was very proud of having had her hair cut in Paris. Which perhaps is quintessentially English. But yes, I think that's true otherwise.
And she, the whole group of women who she associated with in the Natural Union are an interesting group of women, all of them. That's why I'm interested in her.
Yes.
Because I want to give a composite portrait of them all in the end. Presumably her feminist connections while she was at Westfield were weakening in a way. I mean, they'd been very important in the 20s and 30s, but birth control and feminist causes weren't the mainspring after 1940, were they?
No, I think not. She'd go on being interested, but she wasn't a moving spirit at that stage.
Did she have any particular attitude to Oxford as such when you went there?
Oh, loved it.
Did she?
Yes.
Of course, she'd lived there for a long time.
And she'd know it quite well.
Yes, of course, that's where her husband had been from, I suppose. It must have had a lot of, insofar as she had sentimental feelings, they must have been aroused.
I think they were, yes.
Yes, and she loved the sheer beauty of the place.
Yes, yes. Well, I must let you both... people used to sort of talk about her as having sort of said this or that or done this or that.
Yes.
Character.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Very much.
Yes. Well, let me unplug my wires.